Argument, United States versus Bounds, Mr. Gross.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Gross. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Marvis H. Bones. Mr. Bones was convicted of mail fraud, money laundering in the District Court in the Southern District of Illinois. And he has appealed from the sentence and the restitution order imposed in that case. His appeal raises six issues. The first is based on the Supreme Court's decision in Booker, and the next two challenges, next three challenges, are based on specific enhancements that were imposed in this case, based on factual findings made by the district court. And those issues, Mr. Bones is contending that the record, the evidence, didn't support the findings. Therefore, the judge clearly erred in making the findings. The fifth issue and the sixth issue have to do with restitution. In the fifth issue, Mr. Bones is contending that the evidence didn't support the court's loss calculation, and therefore the restitution order was erroneous. And in the sixth issue, Mr. Bones is contending that because the revised restitution order, which increased the restitution award, was made more than 90 days after sentencing, and there was no finding of or showing of good cause that the court had lost jurisdiction and could not make that last revision to the restitution order. I would address the Booker issue first. There are no questions about other issues.
Don't you have a very serious jury appeal waiver problem?
Yes, Your Honor. I do have a serious waiver problem, but I don't think that it's an insurmountable problem.
Why isn't it?
Well, it's not because it is because there's ample writing, ample judicial writing about the enforceability of waivers.
Right, they're enforceable. So what's,
right.
What's
and,
the
and
problem?
Even about the problem is that what Mr. Bones, it turns out, was waiving was something that he didn't know existed, that in fact nobody in the courtroom knew existed. And
what was that?
That he had a Sixth Amendment right to sentencing under a different procedure, to fact finding under a different, to be free from a sentence based on judge found
facts.
Yeah,
but if you waive your right to appeal, you waive your right to take advantage of changes in law.
Well, there was more. There's more than just the fact that not only Mr. Bones but nobody knew what it was that he was waiving.
What difference does it make? The law is constantly changing, and one thing you give up when you waive your right to appeal is the fact that there might be a favorable change in law in your favor.
I don't see how these
waivers would be worth much less to defendants if somehow they were reserving the right to throw aside the waiver if there was some judicial decision somewhere that gave them a better shot at a reversal.
I agree with Your Honor, except that there was more in this case. In this case, throughout plea colloquies in both of Mr. Bones' cases, there were active representations, not made in bad faith, made in perfectly good faith, by the court, that this is the way it's done. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to make the findings based on a preponderance
of
the evidence.
Of course, but it's implicit that if the law changes, then the procedure that the district court outlines might turn out to be invalid.
That's
just the breaks. As I say, the government will be less. I mean, the government makes concessions in exchange for extracting these waivers of appeal, and it'll make fewer concessions if these waivers don't have teeth, because every time there's a new decision, the defendant says, "Oh well, I didn't anticipate that."
This was a. I have a couple of lines of response to that, if I may. This is a sea change in the Booker decision.
Well, are you going to have a sea change exception? I mean, how is that going to be applied by courts? Are you going to say that if the Seventh Circuit changed the law, that doesn't upset the waiver, but if the Supreme Court does, it does?
No, I think what I would say is that I'd fall back on and ask the court to look back at the what the Supreme Court has said about waivers of fundamental constitutional rights, particularly Johnson versus Zerbst, but also McMahon versus Richardson.
No, but your argument is that you're going to say it's not knowing because no one knows the future. Well, that deprives these waivers of their force. Yes, of course your client didn't know the future.
Well, and again, I don't want to unduly belabor the point, but it is the point of the appeal that in this case you have not only the fundamental change in process, not only the fact that it affects a fundamental constitutional right, but also the ongoing directing of Mr. Bones to the knowledge that you're not waiving anything about judicial fact finding.
We haven't considered all that fundamental. We've said it's not retroactive.
I'm sorry, the court has said
it's not
fundamental.
No, it's not retroactive.
The position that Mr. Bones would take, that I would take before the court, is that if you have a right under the Sixth Amendment to be free from sentencing under a mandatory guideline system, and if the sentencing court tells you, as you're deciding, making the final decision to plead guilty, that this is how the sentencing system works. It works the way that it no longer does work, the way it wasn't going to work a short time later. That at that point you look at and ask the court to look at Johnson versus Zerb. The court must, quote, indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver of fundamental constitutional rights. The right to be free from that, and maybe I'm overestimating the significance of the Booker decision.
If
so,
I
probably should stop beating the dead horse. But I thought that I and the rest of...
Well, let me ask you about another question. Do you regard Booker as applicable to restitution? That is, that the guidelines relating to restitution went down the drain with the rest of the guidelines?
I'm not prepared to concede that Booker doesn't apply to restitution. I haven't raised the issue. I know
you haven't raised it.
I have not raised the issue. This court addressed the matter a few days before Booker was decided in the Supreme Court and indicated at that point that it saw no applicability. Of course, Booker in the Supreme Court looks a little bit different than Booker did in this court last summer.
Mm-hmm.
If there is plain error there, I don't want to waive that or concede it for Mr. Bones. There is a fairly broad-based challenge in Mr. Bones' brief to the restitution order on two grounds. It may be that challenge is broad enough to embrace the applicability of Booker to Bone. So I'm not prepared to concede it. I just don't have a better answer for it this morning.
That's fine. You want to save the rest of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Clark?
Good morning, Your Honors. With respect to your last question about restitution, the government in its latest brief pointed out to the court that the Swanson case from this court suggests that Booker does not apply to restitution. The reason being that with respect to the restitution statute, there is no maximum penalty. In fact, it's not even really truly a criminal matter. It's more of a civil issue. It's a matter of restoring a victim to his former status. So it doesn't really relate, the statute doesn't relate to punishment at all, and therefore Booker is not implicated. Going back to your other questions to my opponent, I think that the waivers in this case, in the plea agreements, both plea agreements, clearly indicate that the defendant is giving up all appellate rights. And as you indicated to counsel, later developments in the law really don't affect those waivers as long as they are knowing and voluntary. And in fact, I believe in a 28J case that I cited to the court, Rubo, that case from the 11th Circuit upholds an almost identical waiver to our waiver, and that comes on January 21st of this year, so it is post-Booker, and in fact discusses Booker, having no effect on the appeal waiver. Furthermore, Your Honor, just to clarify matters in terms of what the government gave up for its part of the bargain here, in the threat case, the government recommended the low end of the guideline range and a potential reduction for a Rule 35 based on continuing cooperation by the defendant. It also agreed to dismiss two counts of Section 1512B, which would have carried a 10-year penalty, whereas the count of conviction carried only a 5-year penalty. Similar concessions were made in the fraud case. The low end of the guideline range was recommended, again, a possible Rule 35. And furthermore, the government, as it did in the threat case, indicated that it would not prosecute the defendant for other crimes of which the government was aware. And I think that it's safe to say that one could see from the charge here, the 1957 charge, the other possible counts of 1956 carrying a higher penalty would have been possible in this case. Your Honor, I think that the brief that I submitted to the court goes through at great length the number of times that the defendant indicated that his understanding was that he would be giving up his rights to appeal. He made those he made that promise knowingly and voluntarily. I think that the record is very clear that that happens in both of the cases. And as I indicated in my brief, if it wasn't clear on the first case, it was certainly clear in the fraud case.
In giving that plea agreement, you say there were lots of other things that were taken into consideration. Was the obviously he didn't know what kind of a sentence you're going to get or even recommend, but the way it was under the fraud case, I guess the once all things considered, it was a sentencing range of 168 to 210, is that right?
Correct.
And then he got the high end of that range.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you said something earlier about he got the low end.
I'm sorry. The government agreed in its plea agreement to recommend the low end of the guideline range, which it did.
I see. Okay, and he got the high end.
He did, Your Honor.
I see.
And as a matter of fact, Your Honor, that would that same issue would go specifically to any Booker argument here, because under the third element of plain error analysis, the defendant's burden under the Rodriguez case, which I cited from the 11th Circuit, it's the defendant's burden to show that there would be some effect on substantial rights. In this case, because the judge went up to the high end, there's no suggestion, no indication from the record that he would change his mind if this case were remanded. And in fact, there's even a not only did he go to the high end, but you may recall that he that the judge was very unhappy about Mr. Bones's recalcitrance in signing off on a number of mortgage releases. And in fact, there was a one of the restitution hearings, I believe on January the 12th, he goes, the judge essentially threatens the defendant with contempt if he doesn't follow through on his promise to sign off on those plea agreements. So given the defendant's recalcitrance there, given the nature of the criminal action where we've got a guy who is defrauding poor people of millions of dollars of money here, I don't see that there's any possibility that the judge would go lower on the guidelines if this case were remanded.
And I assume he could go higher.
Presumably he could, yes.
could go higher. I thought you said he sentenced at the top of the range.
Under the guideline range, yes.
He didn't go to the statutory maximum.
Correct, right.
Okay.
So he, under Booker now, he could go higher. So that would be even more of a reason to go ahead and affirm this case now, and that's what we would ask that the court...
Is the statutory max 360 months?
Statutory max, I believe, is 240. Yeah. That's a 20-year statute.
Yeah. The fraud fee.
Yes, sir. Actually, let me change my.
I just have
position.
Down here. It's 360, but
I think
it's higher than 240.
It is higher on a straight fraud case. It would be 240, but because there was an effect on a financial institution, it could go up to 360. In other words, there was some fraud on the bank, so theoretically, it could go up to 360.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Gross, how much time does he have? 2 minutes.
How much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Thank you. The Rubo case, maybe this court might reach a different conclusion than the court did in Rubo. That came down to a troubling for that court, I think, parsing of the Booker opinion and parsing of the plea agreement in that case to determine what the intent of the parties was. And this court might come to a different conclusion than Rubo did. With respect to the number of times that Mr. Bones said that he understood what he was waiving, I don't quarrel with what the transcript says. Of course, it does have him saying repeatedly, I'm waiving and I understand what I'm waiving. Nobody understood what he was waiving unless we talk in the abstract sense of he's waiving anything that exists under the sun, no matter what. And that, I think, can't be reconciled with the notion that you indulge in every in order to get to an indulgence of every reasonable presumption against waiver, you have to at least consider what was on his mind when he makes that waiver.
And you understand, though, that he could be exposed to higher sentence.
The what Mr. Bones is placing his hopes in that regard is the error in his claim that there is a significant error in the loss calculation. This wasn't a crime against where the ultimate victims were poor people. It was mortgage companies. And the loss calculation was done in a way that simply wouldn't apply once the victims, as the court identified them in its final restitution order, are.
But if we affirmed all the other rulings of the district judge, so it was just a pure Booker case, would your client really want to have a resentencing on the identical record?
If I was him, I would not. Last I heard, Mr. Bones would.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Next case for argument, United States.